Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
Okay. We're cooking with gas here. Beautiful day in Austin. How's it up there?
It's going to get better every day this till the weekend. And so we're starting 50. We're in 50s this afternoon, 60s on Saturday, and Sunday we'll be in the 70s, and no rain in sight till a little bit on Monday when the Cubs open.
Do their home opener. That sounds good. Yeah, we're ideal weather here. Cold at night, blazing hot in the day. So you know how that goes.
Yes.
Okay. And so let's cook. We got a lot of stuff today. Wow.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff and a really nice topic. Money.
Yes, John, the CPA / MBA, loves this topic. So do I, frankly. I mean, it's the easy way to get to the bottom of a problem.
It sure is. It's amazing how you can come up with a problem and you kind of try to peel the layers off of the problem. And what do you see at the end of it? But a big dollar sign. And that dollar sign is resting in a lot of different areas, including the areas we normally cut, which are sports, film, and news. So we're going to try to, you know, talk about that in the context of money and give it some good examples, because it's
yes,
all over each of these industries. But it's kind of funny if we can kind of make it a little topical, what's current and what's happening.
Yeah.
So my normal sport to talk about is baseball, but right now it seems an area that's very specific that's come up in the NBA is what's called the resting epidemic.
Resting, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, and because what's happening is NBA is kind of in a special slot. If you take a look at the big three, not being disparaging than hockey, but usually you think in terms of, you know, baseball, football, and basketball, mm-hmm, when you're taking a look at the major sports.
Right.
And what's happening is that their schedule is just kind of at the number of games they play is at the point where, you know, traditionally players have played all the games. But now what we're finding out is that a lot of times these particularly these marquee teams, the big ones such as the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors and the San Antonio Spurs, which kind of started this whole thing, are finding it to their, what they feel to be a good strategy to rest occasionally during these 82 games as they get ready for the playoffs. So we're finding that the protest for this behavior is coming in several directions. Number one is that the fans are upset.
Sure.
And particularly, and I'm going to kind of give a little background to show you how this really kind of uniquely fits the NBA. And then the commissioner of basketball for NBA, Adam Silver, has also brought to the attention of the owners, this is something that we need to address. Our public image is being tarnished by the fact that we are not addressing this issue. And so I'm going to give you a little background as to what I feel brought this up. And it's not, you know, I'll try to be brief about it but to give a basic platform. Right now, there are 30 teams in the NBA. There are 15 in each conference. There's a Western Conference and there's an Eastern Conference. And the number of teams that's come aboard is like in the mid-60s, there were 16. So we've ballooned up from 16 to 30. From the mid-60s to where we stand right now. And the Western migration, and this plays an important thing, part of this problem, is that the Western migration of teams started in the early 60s with the movement of teams to L.A. and San Francisco.
Those
are big markets, and that really affects what the travel. So the fact is that the other thing about the about this is that the teams traditionally, they have an unbalanced schedule, so that the Western teams only play the Eastern teams two times, one at home and one away. So quite often, a fan's opportunity to see a marquee team, a marquee player, is only going to be once. They look at the schedule, they see that at the beginning of the year, they buy their tickets, and they're ready to go see a superstar. The number of games that have been played really hasn't changed that much. From the mid-60s on, the NBA has played 80 to 82 games, and that's where they presently are. And the fact is that, you know, the season starts in April, starts in October, and regular season ends in April. So we go from late April to October, and then we have 2 months of playoffs. So, you know, this problem, the resting problem, is basically a problem that is a smaller part of a bigger problem. The image of the regular season is being tarnished for a variety of reasons. Number one, saying that, well, the teams are getting ready for the big season. And so as a result, the significance of an individual game during the regular season has been kind of diminished in the image of it. And there's another thing that was kind of happening when you talk about resting. It's not only the good teams that are resting, but another part of this that we're not going to talk about is what's called tanking. Teams are not playing that well. Yeah, you say tanking. Oh, this is gambling. No. What's happening is there's a draft. And at the end of the year, the worst teams can get the best position in the draft. So it's tanking. So what they're doing is they're losing games, so they have an opportunity to be the worst team. Now, they've kind of addressed that issue by putting it into a lottery form where they basically have the top, the worst five teams doing it with a weighted scale. But still, there is an element of tanking, which is, again, just another thing tarnishing the regular season. So that's the kind of background of all this. And where does the money come in?
Yeah.
Money comes in with the TV contracts. Right now, we have got four different TV, companies that are involved in this. We got the ABC/ESPN. ABC owns ESPN. We got TNT. And we've got the latest on board. Now, I don't know when it started, but as we know what's happening, there's a specialization in cable TV, and we're seeing it in all different, all sports. There's an NBA channel, there's a baseball channel, MLB channel.
Right.
All of them have these. So we
streaming. There's streaming on phones and what have you too.
Each of these are providing. The internet is another element of this, which allows these stations and also not only the stations but the industries themselves, the NBA, MLB, to have another way of basically getting their product out to the public. Now, the thing is that the solutions seem pretty obvious. And what's going to happen, just to kind of give this framework in terms of timing, for the last 2 days, the NBA owners have been meeting with the commissioner. It's a regular scheduled meeting.
Right.
Nothing has basically come out of that meeting yet. I was anticipating that maybe this morning there would be something coming up, but it hasn't. So I can kind of predict what I think might come out of the meeting and what might not come out of the meeting. Obvious solutions to this would be to have blackout dates. In other words, the marquee teams are basically pretty well known. The Golden State Warriors, and the Cleveland Cavaliers and San Antonio Spurs, a few more. And the thing is that these what they could do is they basically could look at the schedule and the commissioner could say these are blackout dates in which you cannot rest players. You know, obviously players, they can get around that by saying, we have an ingrown toenail right now on this one player. He won't be able to play tonight. And by the way, that isn't, as funny as that might sound, Michael Jordan had problems with ingrown toenails, but Mike found his way on the court practically all the time.
We know that.
So, yeah, we got and then we could also black out those one-day games. Mm-hmm. Those one-time games. So I think that the blackout dates are going to basically go with the marquee teams. There are some other, another solution that's being looked at is to expand the season a little bit more. Now, God bless. I mean, these sports industries overlap so bad already in terms of their seasons. I mean, right now, the NBA's starts in late October. They hardly want to get any further, earlier. But, that's probably what they'd have to do. Now, why would they want to expand the actual length, in terms of, days? That would give them an opportunity to then spread out the games a little bit more, which then would be a disincentive to the resting. Right now, a lot of these NBA teams, they have what I call one-on-ones, where they play two times on the road, and they'll play one game, you know, they'll play like a Tuesday, Wednesday. So the idea is to put that rest day in between and eliminate some of those, and they can do that by, you know, by expanding it maybe a week. But the solution that this, what I would call the solution in the sky, the one that'll never happen, the obvious one would be, well, why don't we just reduce the games? Well, guess what gets in the way?
Money.
So, right. You know, I personally think that, you know, that there are some other, the solution for the one day, you know, is, was possible. Now, there's another little, what makes this unique to NBA? Number one, the NBA is like, in terms of their number of games, is right in the middle. Football has got games, 12, you know, 16 games. And they're weekly, and they've actually kind of addressed us a little bit by having the bye week. So that kind of helps them in that regard. And they can also control rest during the week by doing a little less practicing. So their players are expected to play every game, and it makes sense. On the other spectrum, you've got baseball, which has got 162 games, which it is expected that they will rest players. The obvious one is a pitcher, of course.
That's a lot of games.
That's a lot of games, and there's also a lot of opportunity for the fans to see these marquee players, you know, they come in and here's another solution I think that is a little radical that I don't think they'll ever do is the football doesn't play every team every year. Baseball doesn't play every team every year. Why don't we take some of the pressure off by not going to these cities, one time a year cities every year? Let's do it every other year. That will take a little bit of the pressure off. Now, you know, I don't think you're going to hear that solution as a part of it. It's not what you call a major part of the solution. Well, because then the city will say, well, we're going to be missing that game that year. You know, somebody's going to complain about it. I like it. I don't think it's impossible to do that one.
I'm with you.
So, you know, the NBA, just to kind of summarize all this, is got an image issue in terms of the regular season. Right now, everybody says the second season, the playoffs is a major season. What they've basically done is this is another piece of their image that's being tarnished, and it's enough that the commissioner has felt a need to address it at their latest owners meeting. It'll be very interesting to see what comes out of it. So,
just to roll this up a bit, what does a seat cost in a game these days, do you think?
I don't know the exact total, but let me tell you right now that the NBA is one of the most expensive sports events. The players have played off very well. So, you know, I would say you could probably, if you want to get yourself just a regular seat, you're going to be paying $75-$80 to get a regular seat. Now, the other thing I didn't bring up is the fact that another thing that's kind of unique about the NBA is quite often they're the only show in town. What I mean by that is that there's no baseball, there's no football.
Oh, yeah.
And so you got Portland is a good example of that. You got Oklahoma City is another one. These are cities that when the sports fan looks at it, this is my this is what I'm going to hang my hat on to cover. So that even accentuates more the need. So what looks to be like a perception to the fan, as you peel the layers off, is back down to money, because the image that the fans make is right on the radar of the big TV, you know, companies, and they're looking at that and they say, well, you cannot tarnish your image anymore. We're paying big bucks. We want to have the premium product out there all the time.
Wow. Well, I have a couple objections to this. Number one is that I'm going to take your angle on this. I'm kind of channeling you now. It seems to me like these aren't very good fans, okay? Some of the greatest stuff you see is the people who are not the marquee players. The minutiae, the quirkiness, the weird stuff is really more fun as a sports fan, really, truly, than some of these big guys who it's all hype, you know? It's like fake news almost, you know? They just blow it up and blow it up and blow it up. And these guys, that's a lot of pressure. Number two objection I have to all this is, this smacks of slavery in a bit. You know, here these guys are, You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know, they have, oh, we don't have enough pressure on us. You know, we're gonna, now we've got to worry about the dollars and the cents and all this stuff. And you know, coupled with the fact that a lot of these guys really aren't prepared for this kind of money flowing into them. And they end up with entourages and crooked managers and agents that are bilking them. So, you know, hey, I think there's, the sports area in general, but basketball in particular is ripe for some kind of renaissance. I would love it if they
boy,
did that.
Are you a spokesman for LeBron James, by the way?
I am, actually.
Sound like you are, but LeBron and you are tight. You are tight, I can tell. LeBron
Train
is
wreck.
One. Yeah, well, the thing is, LeBron is the major spokesman right now. If you wanted to put one player up there on the pedestal that is really voicing the player's viewpoint on this and the need for the rest and the strategy, it is LeBron. It's LeBron against the commissioner. It's kind of neat. So
By the way, he's just warming up. Get ready. By the time you know you and I are really old, we're going to be talking about Senator LeBron James.
Oh,
my prediction.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah. Mark the date.
Yeah. Just to kind of. Yeah. I think your point's well taken. But I will let you know just to bring this one more point, and this is that I'm right there with you in terms of what I like to see on the court, in the field, wherever it might be. I want to see the unusual. I want to see, I have my own perception based upon my knowledge as to what I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I am not the fan.
Well, John, you will be soon, because you know that pretty soon LeBron will be listening to our podcast, so I just won't let you know.
Okay. Well, it doesn't sound like I'll be a fan. It sounds like LeBron will be a fan of mine.
Oh, there you go. That sounds right.
Okay, well, I think that's enough about NBA. If you have any idea here. Ooh, film.
You know, originality.
Money, creativity, originality, as we take a look at film. What brought this onto my radar was the fact I noticed that Michael Keaton is being considered for a role, not Dumbo, but he's considered for a role in Dumbo. I thought, well, this is just another voice. Maybe he could be the voice of Dumbo. I soon realized that this isn't what it's all about. What it's about is the fact that the latest thing in terms of remakes is for movies to be made going from animated film to what we call live action. You know, it's a regular film. So I thought, well, gee, that's kind of interesting, but why would they even want to do that? Well, guess what? Right now, as we speak, looking at the first quarter of the film industry, the highest grossing movie is a movie called Beauty and the Beast. Now, I'm a little too old to remember seeing that as a kid, needless to say. But what's happened is that that movie was gone in the first quarter, is gone from animated to live actions, with people such as Emma Watson and Kevin Kline, a variety of people, fairly well-known stars. And, you know, and they've actually kind of got a deep credit list of well-known actors and actresses in it. So it got me to thinking, boy, you know, this creativity thing and this remake is, you know, really kind of overtaken the industry, so to the point that quite often we're caught up in a world of remakes. And if there's another section of this lack of creativity, which is sequels, prequels, and all that. So I'm going to concentrate on looking at, you know, it all boils down to animated versus live action is the most recent form of remake, but remake goes back. It's got an incredible history, and in addition to the fact that it's almost it's recognized by the Academy, you know, because they give awards for an adapted screenplay, and they give one for an original screenplay. Oh, and as you take a look at through, I was going to say, well, I'm going to get an idea what this adapted is all about, or what these other forms of creativity. And as we take a look at it, they're all over the place. Books, obviously, you go from books to movies. It's a source of, and Gone with the Wind, GW3 is right there at the top of the list. You could call Godfather, and these are like historical fiction. But we've also got, you know, books that are, you know, movies that are being made out of, you know, just pure history, such as All the President's Men, etc.
Yeah.
Another one is plays. Now, typically you think about plays, you know, like musicals being, you know, like Hello, Dolly, etc. But yeah. even serious plays, such as Driving Miss Daisy. You got short stories, which is kind of a short list with All About Eve. And even TV shows, in the early history of TV, TV content was quite often, a big portion of it was teleplays. So we got out of that thing, such as Marty, which is, I'm kind of dating myself, as a 50s movie that was won the Academy Award.
That's a great movie.
It is a really good one. It's worth watching. Then we get into the movie to movie. And you know what? We got you in, and the fact is that we've got, you know, we got all these U.S. movies that are, you know, been remade, you know, several times. And by the way, just to bring some the completeness to this, when I took a look at the original, you know, the creativity, where does it lie in you know, those Academy Awards, and I find at the top of the list, the person who has gotten nominated for the most original screenplays is Woody Allen.
Oh, my God.
Woody Allen has had 16 Academy Award nominations, and he's won 3. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, Woody thinks that the world begins and ends in New York City. So as a result, he has not been exactly with open arms. He won't go to L.A. So he's so I think when it gets down to the crunch time and who wins the award, I think that there's a little bias against Woody in that regard.
Other biases exist also, of course, more recently, but...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's a
marrying
a
stepdaughter, et cetera.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact is, this is not a new... This whole element of creativity is not... It's not new, you know.
Well, again, to roll this up, the problem here is that people... These guys don't want to back a movie that has a high risk level, right?
Risk.
Because,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, and the risk exists with, well, can... Is this actor or actress going to go on a bender and ruin the schedule? So there's insurance to think about. And, you know, then, you know, once you get out of the actors and actresses, there's a story itself. Does this story have legs? And you're right, man. I mean, vaudeville went to radio, went to TV, plays, same thing, went from radio to TV. And, you know, all these things have kind of done that movement. And, again, it's minimizing risk. Maximizing and some things which amaze me, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that thing is made every 10 years.
Yeah.
Superman, every 10 years. I mean,
yeah,
really.
you get into the remake, and then you start getting into the genre where you've got you start with a remake, and then from the new remake you then start doing sequels.
Yes.
So
yes.
you got all these things kind of convoluted together. I would just say that, you know, the money. Well, here you said you mentioned it, the second one with the bottom line, but the fact is that you also reduce the risk by reducing your expenses, and the fact is you have a known commodity which doesn't require as much marketing necessarily as you would. Although they still pretty hype these things, but
but word of mouth.
Yes,
you have a fan.
Yeah, the Star Wars fan. I mean, they have a built-in audience that they've been able to cultivate based upon the fact that this is a sequel situation. But there's also a curiosity, I think, to remakes as to is it going to be as good as the one before, you know. And so I think there's a lot of different things going on in that regard. And so creativity has been kind of... You know, it's been stifled to some extent, but that doesn't mean that creativity hasn't been exactly eliminated. I think the good news out of all this, if we want to give some upside to it, is we've got independent filmmakers. And I mean, it's sort of like even the big studios, and when we talk big studios, we're talking the big six, Disney, Warner, 20th Century, Universal, Columbia, and then Paramount. They have their own little. They have their own departments. I hardly call them little, which basically deal with small films, deal with independent films, and the fact is that indies have caught on, particularly in the 90s, and they have an outlet, and that outlet is these film festivals, which is another topic, but it's an amazing thing, and it's got a history and a life of its own. But film festivals have become very big, and that is a platform, or that's a means by which quite often these independent films get an opportunity to... And it's kind of interesting when you say, well...
Con.
when you look at all this, you know, because even the film festivals themselves are kind of, you can go all the way back to Cannes, which is 1946, which happens to be my birthday, my birth year. And it's a, you know, the biggest film festivals, this all started not in the U.S., but it's a big thing. France. Cannes, Berlin is a big one. Venice has a big one in Italy. And one that snuck in there that I wasn't aware of that is the biggest, although maybe not the best known, is in Melbourne, Australia.
Really?
And it started, yeah. It's got a real big, now, so even in the U.S. is not even the biggest in North America.
Oh my God, what's the biggest?
Toronto.
Oh, you're right. I forgot about the Toronto Film Festival. That's a big
How
deal.
Soon we forget. Yes, it is a very big deal. And I mean, most of the other cities have captured it. I mean, Chicago's and Austin, where you live. We both have what are considered top tier film festivals. So,
I guess
my prediction here out of all this to kind of get towards the end is the fact that I think what we're going to find is what happens is studios react to money. And I think we're going to find that this animation to live action is not going to end with Beauty and the Beast. And although they're having some trouble scheduling Dumbo, I think we're going to find that you know, and this might catch on, it might not. I was kind of amazed by looking at the ratings and that the movie, you know, when you go to IMDb, you can get the critic ratings and they get the user, the fan ratings. And the fan ratings for Beauty and the Beast weren't that great. The critics were good, so I think it's still the shelf life of this phenomena of animated to live action. I'm not sure that it's going to be a long life.
I think the reason they do it is because, you know, the animated films take so much money to create, and we should also state that there are some studios making totally 100% original animated films.
Exactly.
Pixar. And that's a big thing.
Pixar, I was just to let you know, is owned by, and I don't know which one of them, is owned by one of the big six. So it doesn't stand alone anymore, although I'm sure it has a relative amount of independence based upon the fact that it does
have
this very slight.
There's a whole area of financial product that's sold by brokers and what have you in order to finance these things. And, you know, back in the 70s, when I sold securities, we used to sell limited partnerships in movies. And the best films to raise money for were films like Bergman films and stuff. Films that would not be smash hits, but would not be failures. Because that's just the right mix. And of course, you can't sell those anymore because rich people don't pay tax. But back when they did, you know, that was a product. So, you know, there's a whole underground of things that people are totally unaware of because it hasn't crashed like the housing market did. So no one knows anything about it, but that's there too. And plus the other thing, back to animation. Animation's a big deal, and animation to live is a big deal because these animation films are like huge things. They're like, and you're a kid or you're a young adult or something, you see these things, they're massive in your memory, they have a huge fan base. So I think that's why they're trying this, John, is because they're leveraging off of the popularity of these expensive animated films, and now they're going to do animation to live. I think that's why it exists, and I agree with you. I don't know if it's going to make it either.
I also, one more little point about this is that the shelf life of an animated film is very long, because kids love to watch them over and over again. You get a you have a new audience every, you know, 4 or 5 years as these kids get bigger, and they keep on watching the same older animated film. So I think that one of the things that's going to be interesting to see whether this is a make or break, what is the audience? I mean, one thing that they've done that I've sensed is that they're going to realize that they need to keep these movies G. You know, so that what's going to happen is that they hope to have that animated audience move over into the live action for these films.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to work. Like an example, my grandson Ian, he really loves to watch some of these anime, and it's to the point where my daughter Rose, she knows which of these films really, and which parts of these films really turn Ian on, and Ian's like 3 years old. So, you know, he's misbehaving or going crazy or something, and all she has to do is pop up, you know, part of, you know, that fish movie, I forget what the name of it is, Finding Nemo or whatever. There's a part of that delights him that he loves. There's one with mermaids, loves. So, you know, these are like These are tools for parents. So, Ian, I can guarantee you, if there was a translation from animated to live, he would be riveted to that thing. He would watch it.
Yeah,
he knows the plot.
Yeah, parents use that. I mean, even though, you know, I'm not what you call close to the kids scene here, being a bachelor without any kids, but I can go to the baseball park and I can see that the person brings their kid and they're not interested in watching a ball game. They flip out the iPad. And that seems to be a means by which to satisfy a kid's curiosity quick when it's needed.
100%. So. No doubt. Okay.
So
fake news?
Fake news, yes. Oh,
which
boy.
Which ain't so fake today.
No, I mean, I think we got real breaking news today.
Yeah. The shit got real last night.
Yeah. So
the countdown to this is interesting, and we'll just hit on this because we are going to tie this back to money also. The real big thing that happened, of course, that everybody knows by now, is that we bombed the shit out of Syria, or Damascus in particular, I believe, and we're talking 30 Tomahawk missiles. By the way, those go for $500,000 a piece, I believe.
Ooh.
So, you know, that's an expensive strike. You know, and everyone thinks, well, we're going by previous bombing of brown people. And what that looks like is, okay, we're going to hit the airport. We're going to hit the missile defense systems. You know, this is the Iraq scenario, which we've done a couple times and people are kind of used to, but it didn't go that way. Tomahawks are not good for creating these huge pits on runways so that planes can't take off, which is like usually the number one thing that's done. Usually they take out air defense and the runways, but they didn't do that this time. They were really targeting specific areas, and they were going after some of the stuff, you know, with the airstrike capacity. But really, I think what this was personal. You know, to go Godfather on us for a second here. This was personal. And you watch the genesis of this. There's Trump doing interviews with Time, the New York Times, in his office, and they're talking, and somehow the Syria thing comes up because of the use of sarin gas on kids, which was horrific to watch, if anyone saw this.
Yeah, it's not
hard. And, of course,
not.
Our president saw it because he watches TV. He doesn't listen to the CIA or any of that other stuff. He's watching TV and he's just going, no. Even Donald Trump was just about moved to tears with this thing. And you should hear. I really enjoyed hearing him say this because, oh, okay, he is a human being, and because he gets.
It's about time we
so
get
often.
That human comes out, you know.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? So he just said, I couldn't believe what I saw. He said it was just totally heartbreaking. These beautiful children, were just maimed, killed in a most horrible way. You know, and dying of sarin gas poisoning is one of the worst. It's not instant. And you do feel it, you do know it, and wow. So I think he just said, I'm beginning to change my thinking about Syria because, you know, just days before he had said they'd make a good ally in the Mideast. And he said, let me correct that. I have changed my thinking. And so that should have been a clue. But sure enough,
It's the first time we've seen the talk turn to action with respect to Trump and defense.
The way he did it is chilling.
I think it's strategic, though, that you point out that rather than, he had a variety of things, but the main thing he was looking for, the attempt was to take care of making sure that this attack got connected to the chemicals. That was the key to it.
Yes, and the way he did it, you know, he was going to sit down with the head dude from China, and for dinner, and so right before he goes to dinner, he pops into the sit room and goes, "Oh yeah, bomb those guys," and then goes to dinner, and he's sitting there, right? And this is really, I'm gonna give him some props here. This is chilling. I mean, here he is negotiating with China about stuff, right?
Yeah.
And you know, everyone. The whole world's watching, in a sense, because, you know, Donald Trump. And so his buddy Putin and China are kind of, you know, he's just in the most casual way possible. Let's have some chit-chat over dinner. And so I'm sure, like, they're chowing down, and there's the interpreter for the Chinese guy, and he whispers in his ear, this guy just bombed the shit out of Damascus. And so, and there's this Trump over there smiling and you know, making chit-chat and how's your pasta or whatever, you know.
And yeah.
That, I got to say, you know, going into this, I'm just going to say this also. People listening to our podcast may think we're like huge Trump haters. No, I went into this thing thinking, hey, you know, the status quo does need to be shaken up. And you, who knows? He may have some stuff up his sleeve that might work. And here, I think, is one of those instances where, I don't like killing people, bombing them with tomahawks and all this stuff. I think it's all reprehensible, but that's the way the world these days. And if you're going to do that, he did a pretty effective job. He leveraged that bombing all over the place, and he handled it in such a way that I think really sent the message. And actually, in the long run, and not even the long run, I think it saves lives and is going to sober up people, and they're going to go, we better not screw with Trump. That's the message he wanted to send, and I think he did. Your thoughts, John?
Yeah, well, my thoughts are, number one, I agree with you that we're you know, look, we know that there's a need for change, and the way and the problem is, how do you make it happen? And most, you know, the people, you know, middle class people, say, yeah, we can change, but is it really going to happen? There's sort of a satirical, sort of facetious way that quite often people look at it. But what happened in the case of Trump is he voiced his to the people who are, you know, lower class, who are desperately looking for change, and they that's what basically put him where he's going to be. But I think we all, not all, but most of us feel there's a need for change, because Washington didn't work as much as Obama had to kind of skirt around and do all these executive orders in order to get what he thought anything accomplished. I mean, Obamacare was probably the one thing he was able to get through the legislature, and of course, which is imperfect.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a stepping stone.
Which lost the House. Well, lost the Senate. And all kinds of stuff, and the House.
So I think you're right. We're not exactly on, you know, Trump's bandwagon, but I think we're curiously looking for, you know, we've got to be optimistic and hope that something will come out of this that will allow us to take the stagnated nature of Washington D.C. You know, get rid of that.
Well, plus, you know, also this week we saw the nuclear option with the Supreme Court nomination and confirmation.
Right.
And wow, that's really a sad day. I heard it said that, well, the Senate just became the House.
Yeah.
Because that was one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Senate.
It's a supermajority.
That 60 votes. 60 votes, yeah. And now there's nothing. It's all up and down.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's the first step of many that might eventually more areas are going to be covered with the nuclear option, and before, like you said, we're going to end up having the 50-50. So
yeah. And then you get also into the tie breaking with the vice president, which is now a really big deal.
Yeah,
those numbers are so close. But on the other side of this, you know, we talked about the need for change, and I think one of the things that we're going to get out of the Trump presidency is the total activation of the general population. I think we're going to see in 2018, it's a midterm, we are going to see turnout at the polls like we have never, ever, ever, ever seen. And it's not just opposition to Trump. It's everybody is becoming politically aware and active. It's even... on the left, it's become a social thing. You know, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, well, we got three marches. I'm not sure which one we're going to go to.
Yeah, it's. I think that the wake-up call was, you know, the fact that that Trump was, what Trump was able to accomplish, and the fact that he was able to cultivate the audience that he needed, that he would get the participation and get the vote out. And it was amazing the way that all was pulled off. And I mean, right. I mean, I think it's a wake up call for everybody.
And it wasn't big money. And that's the thing. I think that if you're talking about the Democratic Party now, they are totally not in control of their party. I think they've lost control of the party. I think Schumer and these other guys, it's the tail wagging the dog. It is the activists who are running that party. And they're the ones who are actually effective at deciding what legislation gets through or what doesn't. I do not think it's the Democrats. I think it's the people on the street, and we saw that with the health care bill.
Yeah.
Best example. And I think we're going to see that again with some other stuff. And the actual people who are, let's say, prominent or visible in the Democratic Party are really just two people, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Those two people, they fill stadiums. They are now on the talk shows. And Schumer gets in there too. So does Pelosi and, you know, the titular heads of the legislation. But really, the people who are making this stuff happen are the people on the streets. And, man, that's an interesting dynamic. And I think, you know, if people sit down on Trump, well, he did one thing. He activated politics in America in a way that's never been done before. And if the Democrats don't get the message and don't figure out that this big corporate money thing is killing them and eroding confidence in them, then they're making a huge mistake. And I think McCain hit something good also this last week. He did a series of interviews, and he pointed out that, you know, hey, everybody says we're house divided and all that stuff. He said, I don't think that's going to last much longer. He says, because every day that passes, more veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are running for office. And those guys and gals, they do reach across the aisle, and they do work with the opposite party because they have a common bond. Yeah. And he did a beautiful interview. If everyone should listen to the Axelrod podcast that he did with John McCain, that is a really beautiful and heartwarming and moving interview, because they talked about his POW experiences a little bit. But what McCain kept doing was he didn't want to dwell on that. He moved that over entirely to the area of partisanship, bipartisanship, nonpartisanship, what the old days looked like, and what he thinks the new days are going to look like, which was really optimistic. And
hey,
I love that.
You mentioned Axelrod. I just wanted to let you know that he tipped his toe into the political arena just a couple days ago.
Yes,
maybe you didn't hear about this.
What he did? You know, McCain told him he should run.
No. He is right now. He is basically in. He became. Axelrod lives in Chicago, and he became the president.
Yes, you know all about that, yeah.
So he became the president of his condo association.
Oh my God!
So I mean, hey, listen.
Wow. Alert
that, that to me is that is the least desirable position I would ever want to have. Is be the president of your condo board. That is asking for trouble. But he's going into some heavy duty. He's starting, and he's starting with a tough assignment. Believe me.
Ooh, just our point. Good. This is going to look good on his TV. This is going to be good stuff. I do hope. By the way, I would like to see him run.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy. He looks at both sides of questions. He's not an ideologue, really. And of course, to do an interview with John McCain when he basically ran against him.
Right.
Last line of the interview was funny. Last line of the interview was hilarious. McCain goes to him. He said, "Who knows, Ax? Someday I may forgive you for beating me."
Yeah, he's beaten a lot of guys in the little underground there, you know, with his position. But where's the money?
Where is the money indeed? Take us there, John.
Well, you know, the thing is that if you take a look at the history of, you know, the money lies in the CNN right now, and and the way that they've approached doing it. But it, just to briefly bring this to some history, the fact is that early on in the history of TV, this was a personal service. This was not a moneymaker.
Correct.
This was something that was it's a PSA is what it was.
Public service announcement.
Public service, and you know, TV goes all the way back to the early 1940s, even, you know, actually into the late 30s. And guess what the first news breaking event was? Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
Pearl Harbor, and what they had to do is the news wasn't even news on Sunday. So they had to fire up the engines and get the station going to broadcast out, and they realized that this was a means by which that they could communicate what was going on, as people are, you know, concerned and frightened about what's the world coming to when Japan is attacking us, you know, at Pearl Harbor. Is the next thing going to be our mainland that we're going to get, you know, bombed? So that's the sort of the start of it. And then, of course, we've got the big stations getting evolving so that we end up having network news, which for the longest time And they realize that, wait a minute, these network news companies, networks are basically creating personalities. And these personalities sell. The Huntley Brinkley, the Doug Edwards of CBS, the Huntley Brinkley of NBC. The CBS then, from Edwards we go to Walter Cronkite. And the other thing is, early on, probably one of the more significant ones that we often forget is Edward R. Murrow.
Oh, man.
He had a weekly station, and really, if you take a look and say, well, now we're talking soft news, but here's the man who basically confronted Taylor Gunner Joe, McCarthy, and probably broke him and in terms of the witch hunt for, communists in the early 50s in the United States.
Great movie, by the way.
Yes, it was a good movie. And the other, and of course, we quite often think, well... We quite often think that, 60 Minutes was the one who really started it all. No, the weekly thing, we can go all the way back to even probably further back. We got Edward R. Murrow.
But he's the marquee guy. If you talk to any newsman, that's their model.
Cronkite.
But mostly Edward R. Murrow, and that was because of his wartime broadcasts.
Exactly. He was right there in the thick of it during the WW2.
And Wolf Blitzer was the counterpart to that.
Yeah, he's the one who basically, these guys, who are in it now, it isn't like they're copycats. They learn. They pay homage and they understand and they realize that that's the way to cultivate their job is to take a look at these people and what they did, and they can expand upon it based upon the technology, et cetera, that they have available to them now. So where are we? We get to 1980. We've got Ted Turner starting a news station called CNN. What happens with CNN is they even had. Does anybody remember CNN Headline News?
So I mean,
nobody remembers that one. But the fact is that they realize that that's kind of cultivates the breaking news thing. And yes. I think the Gulf War is really where the light bulb went off in terms of cable news realizing that, we can really create an audience. We can really we can spike our audience with breaking news.
Yep.
So then the idea being is that right now, the idea is, what we need is we need to go out there and find breaking news.
And good luck. It's all breaking news now.
So what happens is they basically lower their standards for breaking news. Before you know it, we've got, three banners on the bottom of our screen with different breaking news, or we have one banner and it just, comes...
It's been tuned out.
Yeah, it is. And it's
who cares?
It's like a friend of mine told me, he says, breaking news has become broken news.
Or breaking wind.
I wasn't going to take it that low.
Oh, sorry, couldn't resist. And just to wrap this all up and bring it to the moment.
Yeah.
O'Reilly. Now we got this scandal with Fox News, where Robert Ailes, not or is it Robert? I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
Ailes, the guy who big muckety muck at Fox. He got busted for indiscretions with the opposite sex, and they voted him out. He's out of there. However, same thing happens to our good buddy O'Reilly, and he's been paying out, it turns out, $13 million between...
$13
million. Between him and Fox. And so this becomes a big scandal, and he gets a brand new contract. But, wait for it, yesterday, tons of advertisers pulled out of Fox because of this. Yeah. This is just like the bathroom thing in the Carolinas, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well,
They want this crazy law, and again, activism. This time, it was the sports guys, the movie
convention guys,
guys, the convention guys. Yes. Bam! They're pulling out. They're pulling out. And the same thing happened yesterday with O'Reilly. O'Reilly is toast. I don't see him continuing. Do you?
I don't either. He'll maybe resurface, but on a much minor scale at best. Brian Williams did. I think so. Wow. What we've got here is you've brought out money in several. We've had brought out money in several fronts on the news side of it, and that is obviously the way that news is approached by these the MSNBC and the CNN is to sensationalize it to the extent that it loses its content to some extent.
Yeah.
So the idea is money to get the ratings up so that we have the advertisers to make this a more profitable venture for us. And then, you know, as you pointed out on the other side of it, is that the power of the advertisers to basically
huge.
Control who our personalities are. It's we're getting the push on both sides.
News is. Yeah. They control who the news is. Like, you know, the best example in modern days that I can think of is really the whole Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton thing. You know, and that was so deep and so, I mean, that is the one thing that's going to keep her and her constituency and her way of thinking about the Democratic Party subdued, is that you've got these, and it's not just the crazy Bernie people, it's actually the phenomenon, the fact that he got zero coverage in 2015, he got almost zero coverage in 2016 when he was filling stadiums. No one was there except for the internet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that carved a big, and of course, you know, why would CNN cover Bernie? Because Bernie's talking about stuff that their sponsors do not want to hear. So there's another place where the money in this thing is huge. Everybody thinks, oh, money in politics, it's all about these big PACs and the Koch brothers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But no, it's also fake news in the media. That's playing a huge part in this thing. And it's like a, geez, you know, you talk about the factions, news and the media and all that stuff, that is like a whole separate thing, and it's like a shadow government almost, the way it works. It's chilling. It's a little bit chilling, I have to say. And what question is, are we going to see, is the Democratic Party going to stop taking big donors and do the Bernie route? Well, you know, that's, if Bernie has his way, of course they will, but there's an awful lot of other people singing that song now who are not Bernie. And so we'll see if that happens. If that happens, then there's going to be a degree of independence and a degree of truth-telling that we just don't hear in candidates, and that is what got Trump elected.
And can we handle the truth?
Let's ask Jack Nicholson. We'll see. He says we can't. He says we can't, but he got court-martialed. They're not going to listen to him.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So anyway, this pretty good show, John. I think we covered a lot of stuff. We tied it all up. It's money, buddy. It's money.
Money, 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 money. Okay.
Right. Well, hey.
Sounds good.
I'll talk to you on the rebound.
Sounds great. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.